What a fang banger.
Hello and welcome to Fang Bangers Podcast. We're chaotic horny friends rewatching the chaotic horny HBO series True Blood. I'm Tasia.
I'm Elise. This week we're discussing Season 3, Episode 4, Nine Crimes. This episode originally aired on July 11th, 2010. It was written by Kate Barnow and Elizabeth Finch and directed by David Petrarca. Sorry to that man for my pronunciation.
All right, so we have our summary from Wiki, and this one is just straight to the point. Sookie joins Alcide at a rowdy engagement party for his former fiancée, Debbie. Eric is given a deadline to locate Bill. Andy gets a promotion and draws Jason's attention. Franklin takes Tara on a road trip. Arlene is annoyed by Jessica's arrival at Merlot's. Sam makes a deal with Tommy and his parents. Bill procures dinner for Russell and Lorena.
That was like one of the
just
shortest
so
summaries.
Succinct.
Good job.
We're here to hit Wiki, the points and move on. Right?
Good job.
I know sometimes they can be overly like... overly detailed, and we don't know that. Like, we're here because we've seen the episode, right? That's presumably.
Yes.
All right. So, first impressions, Elise.
So, I was thinking about how the engagement party, or the branding party, I guess you might call it, in this episode is one of the, like, quintessential season three scenes for me, and, like, one of the biggest things I remember from this season. So I was really excited that it was in this episode, but this episode felt like it had a million things happening at once.
It really does. It feels kind of messy. It's like trying to do everything at once. And it's interesting that you bring up that engagement party or like cult scene, as being
cult indoctrination
kind of like a quintessential
ceremony.
Right. Yeah. as being like a quintessential season three, 'cause you're so right. It absolutely is, but it's not. Like I've mentioned before, I don't have a ton of strong memories about this season as a whole. But now that I rewatched that episode, I'm like, oh, yeah, that is absolutely a key season three moment.
Yeah. But I think
it's interesting also, because like the. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say that and also Franklin being terrifying.
Yeah. No, he is. He's like the new Marianne for me. Like I find Marianne genuinely so terrifying. And
yeah.
Franklin is similar, just like a great sense of like just insidiousness from them.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned like how kind of all over the place this episode is, and I think that's so true, because like I don't know, I feel like with True Blood's like so far that we've gotten is like they always hit the ground running, they're always hitting all these plot points, but now that the show has kind of expanded in terms of characters and in terms of like it's not so Sookie focused anymore, like Sookie and
right.
Bill like love story kind of thing. It's everybody's having their own adventures and kind of going off, so we have
yeah.
so many plot lines to hit now that it's like normally by season four like we know what we're doing in this, or I'm sorry, normally by episode four we know what we're doing in this season, but right now it still feels like we're setting everything up. Which
right.
Makes sense, and it kind of, you know, it makes sense, but like it's kind of disorienting because there's
right.
so much kind of all over the place.
And I think part of that is that at the end, toward the end of season one, we like got Marianne showing up already. We have a lot of the start of season four happen at the end of season one, and I don't think that is as much the case this time, because at the end of season two, we really just have Eggs is killed and Bill's kidnapped. Like, there's not...
Yeah.
I mean, there's obviously they defeat Marianne and all that, but, like, that doesn't... That closes. That doesn't open. So it's very
right.
much, like... I feel like we started later.
That's so true, yeah. All right, so should we get into it?
Let's hit it.
All right. Do we want to start with our little baby vamp?
Everyone's favorite baby vamp, yes.
Everyone's favorite baby. At least ours, maybe not like Pam's or...
I mean, Pam just doesn't know that yet.
They'll get there. They'll get there. I have faith.
When I said everyone, I was like speaking for us and also for Melissa and Lozzie, who I'm
yes.
sure would not be upset
yes.
for me saying that.
We can, yeah, we feel confident speaking for everybody on this.
I mean, she's really just the only baby vamp also. So, like, you have to hate Jessica for her not to be your favorite.
She does not have a lot of competition in this category. That's true. But I feel like even if she did, still the favorite.
Yeah, no, she's the best. Gets a job as hostess at Merlot. But she can't serve liquor because she's not 17 and she's not 18 yet. And I guess it's unclear where if Sam thinks that she'll, like, ever be able to serve liquor, but the way he talks to Jessica,
it seems like a sentence, right?
Yeah, she's like, I'll never be, like, I'll always be 17. Yeah. And that's just stupid.
It's so silly, and it feels very much like her regenerating hymen that, like, will never go away. It just feels like one of those things, like in terms, like, I know, like, vampires are still relatively newly out of the closet, so, like, legislation is still, like, being created for, like, their whole situation, like, in terms of legality, but, like, there, like, at some point there needs to be some laws in place, yeah, that account for a vampire's, like, actual age. And, like, the whole thing is like, oh, but they're not actually alive is a stupid argument because they're walking around, they're, yeah, sentient,
they're having, they're
participating in society. Mm-hmm. Exactly. They're growing as people, hopefully. So
some of them,
they're conscious on this planet, so, like, for a certain amount of time. So, like, someone being 17 forever is not a thing, even if they, yeah, are immortal, even if they are, like, stuck at one age, you know, like, they're still accruing years and experience, right, and hopefully wisdom. So it's goofy. It's real goofy.
Yeah. We talk about all the other vampires on this show as, like, how long they've been alive and not alive. Like, we wouldn't say Bill's 35, or I don't know how old Bill's supposed to be. But, like,
yeah,
we wouldn't say it that way. We would say Bill's 250. We would say Eric's 1,000 years old. So I do legitimately think that Jessica hasn't had her 18th birthday yet. I'm pretty sure. So, like, I get it for a few months. But eventually, I mean, let her serve at the bar.
I know. It's crazy to think about the fact that, like, it's been maybe, like, 3 months since this show started. Yes. In terms of, like, their timeline, that's wild to me. But, yeah, like we talked a lot about Godric when he was around and how you really felt the weight of all of those years that he had lived. Mm-hmm. So, like, you're not going to be, like, you know, because Godric was, like, 18 or 17 when he was changed. Nobody's calling him 17 or 18. They're calling him 2,000 years old because that's the weight that he carries. And you can feel that. You can see that in him. So it's silly, like a silly thing.
It is silly, but I also think it's interesting because, like, Sam is not a vampire. And so he may have a different view on it than we do because, like, I'm not going to lie, like, we are Team Vampire. We love the vampires. That's why we're doing this podcast. So we're going to see their community the way they want us to see it, which is that Godric is 2,000 years old. So when Jessica says, like, I'm going to be 17 forever, like, she might think that's what Sam thinks. So we'll see, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's something that changed, but...
It also just might be, like, how she is still dealing with the trauma of being turned a vampire. Like, these are still, like, such new concepts for her. And, like, she hasn't met a 2,000-year-old. I mean, she's met Eric, so, like... But Eric doesn't necessarily carry those 1,000 years. Like Godric carried his 2,000.
Yeah.
So, I, like, from her perspective...
Eric, but under,
like,
the surface.
Like, right.
It's deep down.
And not anywhere where Jessica's seeing. So, like, no. I think it is fair from her perspective, now that I think about it, that, like, that's still kind of a trauma that she's, like, trying to wrap her head around, like, a concept.
Right. Yeah, I could see that. She has that old church buddy that comes into Merlot's, which actually jogged my memory that she's not from Bontemps. She is, like, from the Shreveport area, because the whole thing when Bill had to turn her, that wasn't near Merlot's, that was near Fantasia. I had just forgotten, so it's not that common, I think, that someone she knows would come into this bar restaurant.
Right. Yeah. That guy, he's so wholesome and, like, earnest. I feel like he always, I don't even know who this actor is, but I know I've seen him in other things. But, like, I feel like he always plays, like, this overly, like kind of a puppy dog type of character. Did you ever, I mean, I know you had to have seen this movie, Not Another Teen Movie?
Probably. I know my
Chris Evans
sister,
and
No, I'm familiar. My sister loved that movie. I just don't remember if I ever saw the whole thing.
So he played the like goofy best friend to like the dorky girl that gets hot because she takes her ponytail down and takes her glasses off or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, he plays like the goofy best friend that's like in love with her. Exactly. Yeah. And he's like the goofy best friend who's been in love with her the whole time and is like, it's very silly,
nice
but it's very like,
yeah,
it's very him like kind of playing this character where he's just like eager and like earnest and very kind of goofy.
I
I think he just has one of those faces.
I feel like I should watch that movie, but like, I've, think that I am at this age where it's, I'm either gonna like think it's really funny or I'm gonna be like, what is this?
So I remember really liking it, but I also am convinced that it has not held up well. But like,
yeah,
I feel like if you go into it knowing that, like, and just being prepared for it not to hold up
like,
very well, then you can still
I'm mostly like, what gay joke is gonna be in this movie?
Yeah.
We'll see. Maybe they were. Well, it depends if it came. It came out in the 2000s, so I have this.
And it's one of those movies where it's like intentionally offensive too. Like it's kind of rolling on
that
vibe.
That I can deal with. Yeah. But
So
have
I feel
this
like
feeling that 90s movies hold up better than 2000s movies. I feel like in the 2000s people were just mean.
Yeah. No, I could see that. I could totally see that.
I'll report back next time.
Please watch this. This is your homework. Go watch Not Another Teen Movie and report back on how bad / terrible / hilarious it is.
We'll do. Before we move on, Hoyt sees Jessica glamoring this guy to like, because this guy comes up and he's like so happy that Jessica's alive. He's like, your parents are gonna be thrilled. And she's thinking, oh, my parents have already been like told to forget this because of the incident when Sookie brought her over there. And Hoyt like sees them together and obviously is gonna get the wrong idea. And I just feel that Jessica needs to learn about being a vampire before she gets a boyfriend.
I think that's such a good point. And also like Hoyt needs to figure out how he is without, because I mean he's literally going from his overbearing mother to and the only thing that got him away from the overbearing mother was like finding another girl to latch onto, Jessica.
He needs to be
and like while we at this podcast love Hoyt and Jessica as a couple, and I will continue to love them as a couple, I do think that they have a lot of growing up and kind of like self-actualizing to do on their own before they can be the best versions of themselves for each other. And I think that's something that's really important so that they can, you know, be in a healthy relationship.
I co-sign that.
Yeah. So hopefully they do that. Let's see. We'll see. Shall we move on then?
To these fucking guys.
Sam's family. These fucking guys indeed.
I said this in the last episode, but, like, I'm so annoyed with them. They are hangers-on. This is just more proof. Like, I feel how Lazzie feels about Letty Mae, about Sam's family.
That's fair. Yeah, they're total parasites. Like, they're opportunists. And I feel like most of this is coming from Jolie. Like, I feel like they're setting that up, that, like, he married a shifter, had two now shifter kids. And you can see him, like, calculating on how to use that to his benefit. Yeah. And it's just super gross. It's really sad. They kind of, like, see – they go to Merlot's. They see everything that Sam has, everything that he's built for himself. And they're like, how can we capitalize on this? How can we get in on this?
Yeah.
How can we guilt Sam into feeling like he needs to take care of us?
Yeah, and they kind of do it, but, like, gradually. Like, they show up, they stay in the parking lot, which, like, I get. Like, hey, we were too drunk to drive last night home. Mm-hmm. Like, we just stayed in the parking lot. Whatever, that's fine. But then, like, they're outside grilling, and they just, like, they finally tell Sam that they're behind on rent, and they kind of start to open up a little bit about their problems, and Sam's like, how often is this happening? And I think that Sam's realizing he's gotten way in way over his head with these people.
Yeah.
And I think it's also
he's regretting opening that door.
Oh, totally. It's like Pandora's box, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that it's interesting when Sam tells his parents that he caught that Tommy was trying to steal from him, and they act as if it's like completely Tommy's fault. And I'm like, you did not show this kid like any other way of living. Even though he's an adult now, like, you manipulated him and showed him that this is how you act around other people. It like really reminded me of the Miranda July film Kajillionaire, which I recently watched with Evan Rachel Wood. And like, her parents were, I forget the mom actor, but like Richard Jenkins played her dad. And they were just like con artists, and she did not know how to interact with people. Like, she didn't know what love was. Like, her parents never even like hugged her, and it feels very much like this. And
yeah,
Gina Rodriguez comes around and is like trying to show her how to like love, and like, I mean, it's just really sad. I will say that those characters are way more charming than Sam's family, so I got through that a little bit more easily, but it just really made me think of that movie. Like, it's the parents' fault.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, they're so quick to blame Tommy for, like, oh, like, I can't believe he did that. Like, first of all, bullshit.
Right.
Second of all, like, I am not convinced that they didn't tell him to do that themselves. Like,
yeah, I'm not convinced remember either.
Enough.
Yeah.
I don't remember enough to know
if we
like,
ever
this
find
is, like,
out, but yeah.
Right, yeah, I don't know if this is like a spoiler or anything, but because I don't remember, but I am not convinced that they did not tell him to do that themselves. But I think it's really interesting. Like, Sam and Tommy have that conversation where he's like, you know, I know you think, you know, you see everything that I have now, and you think I had it easy, but I was abandoned when I was 15, and I had to make it on my own, and like, you know, I see that you had it really rough too. And Tommy just kind of shrugs it off, like, yeah, whatever, like, you're done with all of that. But, like, I think Tommy has a point here. Like, I think that even though Sam did get abandoned and did have, like, horribly traumatic things happen, and the only way he was ever able to get out of it was because he was able to steal all that money from Marianne to get himself started in life, I still think he was better off than Tommy, who has endured, like, as yet, untold trauma at their hands for his entire life that we still don't know the extent of.
Right.
But everything that I remember about what he's had to go through with them is incredibly fucked up. So that's going to be interesting to watch unfold.
I think we can talk about that a little bit in the spoiler section. But like, it's not good.
Yeah, it's real bad. All right, do we want to put these terrible people away for the moment?
Yes, please.
All right. Let's move on to Eric, Pam, and Lafayette. My dream blunt rotation?
Yeah. With me there, of course.
Yes, of course. And Melissa, we cannot have a blunt rotation.
No, we can't.
Melissa. Shout out.
That's funny. Eric starts by having this daydream about Sookie of like flying up to her window, and I was like, I want this to fucking happen. But it also reminded me of have you ever seen the like movie version of Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
I actually have it, which is wild because I am as I have frequently mentioned, a huge Buffy fan. So I think it's one of those things where I'm like afraid to hate it, so I haven't watched it. But
it's on my list. Don't know if this helps, but it's like completely, when I say completely different, it's very like campy and like over the top, but it's like, it doesn't have the same vibe as this TV show for me.
Yeah.
So it might be like separate enough. But I feel like,
I think it will be, yeah.
I think that you should watch it because it's like not even 90 minutes.
So. Yeah.
But there's a scene where, like, David Arquette is in it, and Luke Perry. Luke Perry is, like, the good guy that, like, helps Buffy or whatever. David Arquette is, like, his best friend, and he, like, floats up to, like, Buffy's or wherever, and they're like, what the fuck? And that's how they realize he's a vampire. But, yeah, it's great. Christy Swanson sucks as a human, I think, in the year of our podcast 2024, but I think it's still a good movie. Paul Rubens is in it, and Rutger Hauer, so who is in True Blood. So
nice, nice connection there.
Yeah. In later True Blood, anyway.
I love that.
I won't say more about that.
I love that he's having this dream that is, or this daydream. Number one, while there is somebody else like naked and dancing in front of him,
not only does
he have this like Estonian hot lady naked in front of him dancing for him, but the fantasy that he's having is actually incredibly wholesome and like very sweet.
It's so sweet. So it's like a sweet like romance sweet. Novel. It's not like you know, it's not like filthy. It's just like really nice. Yeah.
It's just like not at all what you would expect, especially like not at all what you would expect to be able to distract him from a naked like lady like dancing in front of him.
Right.
So it's very sweet.
It is really nice. Lafayette tries to sell V to those those racists, I guess. I was like, are they going to be racist or homophobic? Oh, why not both?
Why not both? Those fucking hillbilly tweakers.
Yeah. And then I was really happy that, like, once they started being shitty to our babe Lafayette, Eric swoops in and rescues him. And that just, like, made me so happy.
I was so relieved because, like, you know, as we've talked a lot of on the show about like its treatment of Black people and the way that they like to just kind of constantly torture them, I was just kind of like preparing myself for something horribly traumatic to happen to Lafayette again. But then Eric came in and saved him, thankfully, because we have enough to deal with Tara in her current situation. But I really love Eric's like he's like holding this guy up by one hand, like by his throat, and is like, he's like, oh, you could kill me, I don't care. And he's like, I think I'll kill your brother cousins first.
That was so funny. I did like that, find that conversation that Eric and Lafayette had in the car afterwards to be really interesting. Eric's like telling Lafayette that to be a good business person, you need to adapt to who you're selling to, not like necessarily like put people off or whatever. And I'm just like, and I don't think Eric's saying this like from like a homophobic space. He just knows that he's been in the world and he knows that that's not going to work for some people. But right. It's like Lafayette did not sign up for this. Like he might have at first, but like you are forcing him to continue doing this. So like, I don't know, it feels very much like I think you mentioned this, that, like, it's a good cop, bad cop with, like, him and Pam. And it's, like, she's, like, mean to him. And then he like, said, like, this part was, like, he was saying it in such a nice way that he was, like, trying to be convincing and stuff. And I'm just, like, leave my baby alone.
Stop trying to dull Lafayette shine.
I know.
But yeah, it's, you know, it's got to be hard to be a, you know, proudly openly gay Black man selling drugs to like white nationalist tweakers in the woods. It's a rough job.
It doesn't sound fun at all. After all of this, Eric gets a call from Pam that they're being raided, and of course he first thinks it's the police, but it's the magister. And Pam's basically like being tortured. But I did really love how Pam and Eric were both so loyal to each other. Like, Eric is basically like, I need to come home, you know, and deal with this and all that. And Pam's like, get help while you can, like, on the phone. She tells him to leave. And then he just shows up to take the blame. And
it's like,
I said this made me so happy.
I've said this before, but, like, Pam and Eric are maybe my favorite relationship in this entire show, like including romantic, platonic, anything. The bond that they have is so fucking important to me. I love them so much. And what we get a lot is very understated. We get like very knowing looks between them. We get like a lot of very familial snark between them. I love all of it. We don't as often get to see something like this where it's such like a genuine like fear and love and all of this so wrapped up, like they love each other so fucking much, and you see it. It just like rack up a line of that and I will snort it. I fucking love them. I want every scene of them together just forever. An entire Eric and Pam show.
I would have watched a spinoff of just the two of them, like doing whatever 1,000% they were doing at the end of the show, like continue on with that. I'm there for it. I completely agree.
They're just so devoted. Ugh,
I know. They're probably my favorite relationship on the show as well. I think that it's the most functional relationship on the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
So I had forgotten that they didn't, like, come out and be like, Sophie Ann is having us do this blood sales. because that would have been treasonous. Because Eric can't go against his own queen. And I was like, Tasia and I have talked about this before, but, like, I was very confused where, like, he's saying, Eric was like, you know, not on my orders. So, like, I took that as, like, we're selling it, but not on my orders. And then Pam's like, it's Bill. And I'm like, why would they be doing something that Bill said? But it's also, like, I don't really care that much that there if there's a loophole, if there's, like, a plot hole or something.
Yeah.
But it just was, like, confusing to me.
I had a slightly, I can definitely see that. I had a slightly different read on it, which was that I don't think that Eric is, like, admitting to selling it. I think he's, like, fully blaming Bill. And that Bill is selling, but not on Eric's orders, like, on somebody else's orders. So I feel like it's him blaming Sophie Ann or, like, hinting that it's Sophie Ann or somebody higher than Eric without saying it because she can't
because otherwise it wouldn't be at Fantasia. Like, it's clear, Eric, like, the storage of it, if anything, like, doesn't make sense, I guess. But,
or I feel like he was saying that, like, Bill was setting him up or something. But,
I just don't think. Like, oh, he put it here when I wasn't looking.
That's how I read it, just because I didn't think. Because I think that even if he's saying, like, I'm selling it, but not on my orders, that's an admission of guilt. And I feel like with how archaic and strict those vampire laws are, that he would still be punished accordingly.
Yeah.
I
think it's so just.
I don't know. Yeah.
I don't think it's that big of a deal. I just was a little confused, and I'm gonna choose to see it how you saw it, so my brain doesn't sizzle.
Yeah. So hopefully they so the Magister gives Eric 2 days to find Bill.
Yes.
And he's gonna keep Pam that whole time, which I don't love.
Yeah. So, no, I'm not pleased.
And I genuinely don't remember how this turns out, so I'm like on pins and needles right now.
I don't remember either.
Well, I guess we'll find out next week.
Yes. That kind of ties in to this a little bit.
Yeah.
In the end. Sorry.
So do we want to, on that note then, move on to my least favorite pairing in this show? Tara and Franklin?
Our biggest nightmare, realize?
Yeah.
Nightmare relationship? Franklin continues to glamour Tara to find out everything she can about Bill and Sookie. And I said this before, but, like, it's very clear to me that when they first meet and they fuck, like, she seems really happy to be there. Like, I don't think he, like, forced her into anything or glamoured her into anything. Mm. And we kind of find out that, like, he's working for Russell because, like, they later show up at Russell's beautiful mansion. But, like, it doesn't make any sense because, well, that's not true. I don't believe that Russell's, like, still employing him because, like, he's gotten Bill
already.
Yeah, because
he's not interested in Sookie. Yeah, exactly. And it feels to me, because, like, Franklin is clearly, like, unhinged and deranged. And it kind of feels like he is, like, a mad dog who got off his leash and now he's just kind of running around doing what he wants and
going by the last really instruction kind of... that makes sense.
He's got big
severely...
mad dog vibes.
I find him severely terrifying. Tara is like still Egg's funeral was like literally 2 days ago. And so it's just like really awful that Tara doesn't even get to like deal with her feelings at all from that. Like, Because,
yeah,
like, obviously, it's obvious to me that, like, she wanted to feel nice, so she went home with this guy. Like, who hasn't mm-hmm. done that? That sounds great.
Yeah.
And so it just is so awful to me that, like, that had to become a more thing. And, like, now she's fucking duct taped to a toilet.
Yeah, it's, like you said, she's dealing with so much trauma already, and she literally hasn't had a chance to catch her breath. She hasn't had a chance to deal with any of it or, like, come to terms with anything. And I think, like, this is what we mean when we talk about the way that this show abuses its Black characters, and in a way that doesn't at all address that the inherent racism in that or look at race critically at all. Like, the show has proven that it's not interested in those kinds of conversations, really, unless it's kind of, like, very surface. Where, mm-hmm. you know, maybe Arlene is called out for saying something, you know, for her, like, microaggressions or whatever. But,
or in, like, a joking way.
Yeah, like, it's constant. Right, yeah. Like, just kind of, like, a tongue-in-cheek. Like, haha, this is racist.
But, yeah.
Like, it's... They're not deep, you know, diving into it at all. They're not acknowledging, like, the kind of trauma that they're putting Tara and Lafayette through. Like, more so than everybody else, I feel like.
I agree. There's this one scene in this episode where it's Bud's retirement party at Merlot's, and Kenya's, like, at the bar by herself at one point, like, having a drink or a shot or whatever, and they, like, make her have to have... They make the one other Black woman in the cast have to make a joke about, you know, killed a Black man, got a promotion. Like, that... It's so... making light of it because there's, like, no serious conversation about that. It's just, like, this is the way things are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that's the problem. It's not... The problem isn't that, like, racism exists in the show because it is a real-life thing and, like, they're representing that, I guess, but it's a problem that they don't really look at it critically at all. It's kind of just, like... We're going to go torture our Black characters some more and make very shallow comments about racism in the South. Like, and that's it.
It kind of reminds me of the same attitude. I've seen this, like, online where, like, the last, like, few years, if it was, like, really cold in Texas and, like, the power got, like, lowered so that people couldn't use their heat and stuff like that. And then someone online would be like, oh, guess you shouldn't vote for Republicans. And it's like, so you're just discounting, like, this entire population of people because of, like, it just feels like the same kind of attitude towards me, like, for me, like,
that's what you get for living in the South. But
exactly.
Like,
and it's like, okay, first of all, there's, like, also voter, like, disenfranchisement. It's just in, like, that word is not properly from my mouth right now. But, like, people, there's, like, people that cannot vote that should be allowed to vote. So, like, you can't say, like, XYZ happened. It's your fault for living there. Like, that's just a shitty attitude.
It's such an ignorance, fucking insensitive, shitty comment to make. I hate it when people do that.
Me too. It's always, like, famous people, too.
Mm-hmm. I know, but people are just like, for you, it might be easy to pack up and move
like,
across state lines.
I'm having trouble
for most,
like,
people,
figuring out moving 10 minutes away. Like, come on now.
Right. For most people, it's not accessible, that kind of that kind of money, that kind of resources. It's just ignorance. It's pure fucking ignorance.
Yeah, it is.
And shitty, self-satisfied fucking... Democrat shit, which I hate.
I was gonna say neoliberals is exactly what I
am,
who I'm talking about. We're talking about the same group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Liberals in general, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Do we have anything else to say about Franklin and Tara, the nightmare road trip?
I will just say that I really enjoyed Talbot's, like, attitude. Like, what the fuck are you doing here? Like,
he really does look at Franklin like this is a mad dog, like, ew.
Like, their house is so fancy. They drink their blood out of little port glasses, basically. Like, what is Franklin doing there?
Or as gelato.
Actually, one thing I do really want to say is one of the only positives about this storyline is the fact that James Frayne is so good at being terrifying and Rutina is so good at being scared. Like, the acting is so good in this story. I just
well, these are this show, like, two of this show's highest punching actors, I think, in terms of just like performance that they can bring to anything. I 1000% agree. As awful as the storyline is, those two together in scenes is magnetic because they are so good.
Yeah, it's very believable. That's why we're so scared.
Mm-hmm, exactly, yeah. All right, shall we move on to Beale?
Beale. I love how my favorite is how Melissa says it. It's just like, she does it like, it's not even accurate. Sorry, Melissa, but like, it's perfect.
Yeah, I think she has the best Beale.
Yeah. Beale has a... it makes me think of that song, You Don't Text Message Breakup. Do you remember that from the internet?
Huh.
Oh, no. It was like this, some internet person that like made all these songs. And one of them was like, You Don't Text Message Breakup. Like, that is basically how I feel. Like, if this was 2024, this conversation would have been over text message. Beale calls Sookie and is like, stop looking for me. I'm back with Lorena. We just made love, which, no, you did not. You just fucked. I don't want to be found. The phone call was so blunt. I felt so bad for Sookie. And I also need everyone to know that I'm making like a phone sign with my hand, pretending that I'm having this phone call right now.
It was brutal. Honestly, it was, but it was also kind of funny, I feel bad about because. Funny too. And this is like, some actors have a cry face that will instantly make me cry with them. Allison Hannigan, I'm looking at you. Mm. But
Claire Danes for me.
Anna Paquin's cry face just kind of makes me. I don't. It's so bad. It makes me like laugh a little bit. It's just so, it's so contorted and so like exaggerated. I don't know. But it's also, he's like, oh, I'm breaking up with you, and she's like, no hesitation. She's like, shut the fuck up. And that was, I loved that, so funny so to much. Me.
It was so fucking funny. I loved it. Was it so funny. Much. I did love when like Lorena popped on the call for a second to be like, hi.
Yeah, I know. So brutal. Funny. Like, if this had happened to me, I would be first of all, I would be trying to light someone's house on fire or something.
Yes.
Like, with Lorena in the background, like, I'm here.
Yeah. Oh my God. This just reminded me of this voicemail I got once. My phone number is a Virginia phone number. And so when I still, like, when I don't remember if it was when I first got the number. I got a voicemail from some woman, like, accusing me of, like, sleeping with her husband, and she was just, like, screaming at me. This is not even related to this, but, like, it jogged this memory.
No, that's amazing.
That I forgot. And I, like, I felt,
imagine if you had answered.
Right? I think she called in, like, the middle of the night, and my phone was, like, off or, like, on Do Not Disturb or whatever. And it was just so, or, like, you know, don't answer a phone number if I don't know it. But, like, it was.
Right.
I was like, this woman hates me. Like, it wasn't about me. I did not know any of these people she was involved with, and I had just gotten the phone number. But, like, it was horrifying. But I just, like, imagine, like, Sookie calling up, like, Lorena and doing that, and that would have been ridiculous. But I feel like Sookie would do something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. Probably. I mean, she's definitely, like, you know, manipulating, we'll talk about this later, but, like, manipulating Alcide into,
oh yeah,
they definitely she's not go, without so manipulation she can deal skills. With this
no for yeah. sure. It's interesting because like Lorena is so happy right now because she's obsessed with Beale, and Beale, like, very straightforward, is like, any passion that you felt during that like fuck or whatever is me mm-hmm. killing my passion for Sookie, which I don't think is a thing, but okay. And that it had nothing to do with you. And I'm like, that is brutal, but also, like, I really enjoy Stephen Moyer when he's being mean. Like, I really think that it's fun.
He's really good at it.
He's so good at it. And I prefer those scenes, like, in an acting sense more than when he's being, like, lovey-dovey with Sookie. Like, I just think he's so good at it. And I'm just like, this man has range.
I feel like he's got so much, like, Bill as a character has so much more personality when he's being a fucking dick. So, like, yeah. Lean into it, maybe.
He really was kind good. Of like Stephen Moyer was really good throughout this whole episode.
Yeah. It just reminds me of, like, not to bring up Buffy again, but, like, when Angel loses his soul and, like, he goes from being just the most boring and basic mm-hmm. and brooding, like, in the shadows guy to, like,
yeah.
he loses his soul and finds his leather pants and his eyeliner and suddenly has a personality. And he's, like, so much fun. And you can see how much more fun David Boreanaz has with that yeah. role. Than he does playing like the boring version. And I feel like you can see the same kind of thing with Stephen Moyer when Bill's being a piece of shit.
I was just thinking how David Boreanaz always plays like the good guy. And I'm just like,
It's just, I would feel like as an actor, like if I were an actor, I would also have more fun playing like nasty characters.
Yeah.
Like, being
oh my
mean
God.
And being bad.
I feel like those are the most, so much those fun. Must be the most fun, like, roles.
Yeah, and you get to, like, especially in a campy show like Buffy or like True Blood, where you really just get to chew up that scenery yeah. and that dialogue, like,
yes,
that seems like it's fun.
I mean, Bill gets to punch Lorena in the fucking face. That was
and
awesome.
Twist her entire head around from the before.
That was insane. I love that he was so overseeing her that he, like, risked touching the silver door to, like, kick her mm-hmm. out of his room.
And, like, so over Lorena.
Yeah, no. I find her extremely irritating. Very pathetic. Very tropey in not a good way. Like,
that's exactly my problem with it, is that the ex-girl, the obsessive ex-girlfriend is a trope that I just find, like, A, it's a misogynistic trope that's written by men. Like, that's just...
Especially
let's get that
since
out.
I feel like statistically, like, men are more likely to... I mean, I hate binary fucking gender shit, but, like, it's definitely scarier being, a femme person and, like, telling a man that you're not interested and, like, with the potential of them to overreact to that than the other way around.
And like, this... It's insulting. It's derogatory. It is embarrassing. It's pathetic, like you said. It is embarrassing, it's pathetic, and it's just makes me this is just such a trope that's written by men, you know, where they a lot of men just love that narrative of, like, oh, Mike's girlfriend's crazy, right? And it's like, well, let's not address the gaslighting and, like, whatever else you did, you know. But so this is the trope that in television, film, fiction, whatever, I absolutely hate. It is, like, my least favorite. It's like the lowest hanging fruit. And Lorena as a character, like, looking at her objectively, she is incredibly powerful. She is beautiful. She is intelligent. Like, why does she give a fuck about Bill? It makes no sense. Like,
it really
if
lowers
a man
herself,
treated
yeah.
me like that. Yeah, exactly. If a man treated
it's funny,
me like
though.
That, like, I would just kill him and move on.
Yeah, like, it's funny. Like, I don't mind it so much in a movie. Like, I do like, I know, I really do like erotic thrillers, and that is often, like, a theme in them. But I don't like it in a TV show because it comes back. Like, a movie's one and done. This is, like, the third or fourth time we've had Lorena act this way. So I'm just, like, the first time, whatever. But, like, I'm just over it because it's, like,
move on,
also
babe.
Been so long. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. It's a tired trope, and it's especially tired when they keep bringing it back in this show with that character.
Yes. On the other hand, and one of the things I really enjoyed with Bill and Stephen Moyer is that Bill tells Russell that before he went mainstream, he used to procure dinner and other meals, I guess, for Sophie Ann and such. So Russell's like, okay, go find us dinner tonight. And Bill is really, really good at this. Like,
this is such a highly specific, like, skill set that I would not have pinned on Bill at all.
Right. Oh, and he also lets it slip on purpose that Sophie Ann is behind Eric selling V and all of that stuff. I mean, he doesn't know the magister knows anything, but I thought that was, like, very funny. I'm like, ooh, I love Gossip Corner with the vampires. But yeah, so
they're all a bunch of catty bitches.
They really are. So like Bill goes out with Lorena and Russell and they pull up to a strip club called Girls, 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 which like, you know, it looked like a fun mood.
Classic.
Yes. And Bill is tasked with getting them dinner. He at one point feels that Suki is in trouble, but has to ignore it. But I think that actually happens after. So he goes and he finds... It's, like, really interesting to me how he's, like, looking at this, like, woman and he's giving her vibes, but, like, not talking to her first. Like, he's playing a little bit, like, hard to get. And then he also kind of confirms that she doesn't have family. She doesn't really want to participate in life at all. And this is the perfect person that you should be feeding on because no one will report them.
If you're going to murder someone,
then right.
At least pick, like, a... someone who isn't too attached to life and right. No one is too attached to them, I guess.
Yeah, no, that was a little sad, actually. But I mean, know. I get why they would pick someone like that, but like at the same time, it just made me sad because like, there's women
obviously
that
better
don't
than
give
them,
a shit about.
Like, right. Yeah.
I did like
he, the... choosing his meals as ethically as he can.
That's. I would say morally, because I think that ethics is like a specific, this is me just riffing, but like, I think ethics is a specific thing and everyone has their own moral scale.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm being so pedantic about that right now. I did like,
Bill's like, there is no ethical consumption under capitalism.
Exactly. Oh my God. I like said that we were saying that like a couple days ago when I was like, I bought books on Amazon. I'm not rich enough to like be discerning about where I buy my stuff.
Yeah. Like I do what I can. All right.
Yeah, exactly. But I did really like the end of because that kind of scene at the end with them eating Anne, the stripper, was the cliffhanger. And I did really enjoy Bill really like being like, all right, I'm going in on this, and then the blood coming down from the vehicle, and
it's an effective shot.
It really was.
It's an effective shot and classic for like horror themes, which is great. But it always and this is where I get pedantic. Where every time I see a vampire feed on this show, and it's so unnecessarily messy, I'm like. Like, every time somebody bites someone and then lifts their head, their mouth is open and everything is spilling out. And I'm like, that's your food, babe. That is your food. Why are you just, like, drooling your food all over the place? Like, not to mention, like, the clothing and the furniture and everything else that you're dirtying up and wasting. But, like, you're literally wasting your food. So, like, how many people are you going to have to eat tonight? Because every time you take a bite, you're just, like, basically spitting most of it out.
What if?
Make it make sense.
What if blood on... They probably have rubber mats in the car, I just decided. But also, what if blood on their skin is like a THC balm on us? And so it just like makes their skin look really nice.
It's like that fucking Olay cream and shit.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how they don't get wrinkles. They're doing like a Elizabeth Bathory, you know?
Did you watch Outlander at all? Like early Outlander.
I did up until, early Outlander. I think up until like season 4 or 3 or something.
Okay, so season 3 is the Jamaica season. Do you remember when What's-Her-Face came out of that like bloodbath?
Wasn't it, oh God, what was her name?
The other time
Scottish
traveler.
Lady that time traveled? Yeah.
Who I love. What was her name? But she, I don't remember, but I loved her. She was so evil.
She was a crazy bitch.
Yeah, I really enjoyed her. But, like, she had that, like, bloodbath thing at one point.
Yeah.
What was her name? It's not going to come to me. I actually, watched that till season, like, 6 and then or 7. And I think I stopped at the beginning of 7. I was like, I can't with this anymore.
It's kind of a ridiculous show.
Yeah.
But it was good at first. I stopped the books, too. I read the books up until she was planning to go back to... like you travel back in time again, and she was like in the book she was like writing a letter to her daughter and being like, whatever you do, don't get fat. And I'm like, all right, I'm done.
Jesus Christ.
Diana Gabaldon is just like a terrible person. So
that whole fandom is kind of terrible, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's it, and the way like she makes like every female character in her books get raped like at least once.
Yeah. It's also, don't at us about this because we don't care what you have to say about it.
Yeah.
I read the first book. I did enjoy it, but like everyone. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets raped. Everyone.
It's so unnecessary. And it's like a glorifying of like female pain kind of thing. And it's always used as like a plot device to like galvanize the male character. It's just like, aren't we done
but
with
even
this?
And then Jamie, every time anybody even criticizes. The male characters get raped.
Yeah, and like every time anyone has ever tried to criticize Diana Gabaldon about this, she's like, she like sicks her fans on them, and it's crazy. It's wild.
Yeah,
it's...
and they're really, anyway, they're really weird about any like modernization or changes to the cult current culture about like the episodes and stuff. Like,
yeah,
it's just ridiculous.
Well, this was an unexpected Outlander tangent that we went on.
I just had remembered that. I just like remember us like talking about the earlier seasons. I felt like, anyway.
Yeah.
Bill.
When it was good, Bill? It was good.
Yeah.
Bill. All right. Are we ready to move on from Bill?
I am ready.
All right. Speaking of moving on from Bill,
that was a great transition. Ayo. I felt it was really funny how like Sookie was being a little hard on Alcide at the beginning about not getting new furniture after Debbie left him like a month ago, like, and hoped that she might come back or whatever. Like, no one's getting a new furniture like unless you actually move somewhere. Like, she left.
Yeah.
You didn't change houses. And then 2 seconds later, Sookie gets broken up with over the phone.
I know.
I'm sorry. It was so funny.
It feels almost karmic. Like, let's not talk shit about how other people deal with their breakups. Because you don't know how far away your next breakup is.
Exactly. Like, what is Sookie gonna go out and buy? It's been a month, man. Bill was in her bed.
Right, and like he was with Debbie for like years, and they were engaged. You know, let
yes, it wasn't just like a few dates; they were going to get married.
Mm-hmm.
But like Sookie is like crying on Alcide's shoulder, which is very nice. It's a very nice shoulder.
It is a very nice shoulder. I will say he's not the best comforter ever seen in my life.
He's like just kind of that like guy, basically.
He's like, yeah. And he's like, you told me to get a new bed, so fuck your pain. the funniest thing, he says something like, you know, these people, they come and they just, you know, they come back into our lives or whatever, and they kick us in the nutsack. And as she's crying, she's like, I don't have a nutsack. And it's just the funniest delivery.
It was so funny. I loved it so much. I don't have a nutsack was, like, almost my blood type this week.
It was almost mine, too. It was a very near thing.
I also enjoyed that, like, he was warm because he's, like, a werewolf. And he was like, it's a were thing. We run hot. And she just goes, I thought you were coming down with the flu. But she's, like, still kind of crying. It was very funny. I do think that, like, in general... these two have like pretty good sexual chemistry.
I agree.
And it's just like, it's very clear that they're both attracted to each other. And like, that comes from the book also. Like, in the book, she's like looking to find negative things about him. Like, in her mind, she's like, that has
would
to
have
be something
to.
Bad.
I mean, look at what he looks like.
I know.
When I was watching and I saw him come onto the show for the first time, I was like, fuck, man. Like, I forgot. Like, he still looks good, obviously. Like, you know, aging like a fine wine. But he walks up to her house or whatever, and I'm just like, fucking damn. Like, this man is
a
beefcake.
I had forgotten, too.
Yeah. It's jarring. You're like,
yeah. How was somebody... I was really thrown off as well.
How does somebody look like that in real life? Jesus Christ.
So Alcide thinks this whole thing is, like, off now, and Sookie's like, no, I'm gonna make him say this to my face, which, like, I kind of get.
I've definitely been that girl post-breakup, but I wish I hadn't. So Sookie doing this is me going, like, ah, don't do that, like, leave it alone. But
I think that
I've definitely been there.
The times I have done it has been not good, I would agree, but I feel like he asked me to marry him in our last conversation is... It feels different to me. Like, it feels
right, absolutely.
Not as cringe, but and maybe, also, like, give it a week or something.
Also because, like the circumstances being what they are, like, she knows there's a more than good chance that like, he is saying this under duress.
Yeah.
So, like, I get that.
And she's not wrong.
But there is that, like, 18, 19-year-old girl inside of me that's going, like, don't do it. Yeah. You've done that before. Don't do it. It's bad. But yeah, I get why she does it.
So Alcide's sister Janice comes by to give Sookie. I guess, like, it's funny because I kind of didn't understand why she was there, because it's not like they're going to the party at this point, right? Or was it like,
I think she was trying to, I think it was intentionally so Sookie could read her thoughts. About,
oh, got it. Okay. Yeah, oh, yeah, because he, like, said that his sister... This is where I...
Because she does, like, the hair of all the people and...
Yeah,
and
yeah.
To find out information.
Got it. So Janice comes, and during that conversation, Sookie finds out that it's not really an engagement party. It's going to be a cult indoctrination party. And also
slash
Debbie's,
Nazi rally, I guess.
Yeah, slash Nazi rally slash Debbie's also hooked on V.
Yeah.
And our girl Sookie tells Alcide immediately.
Immediately, like, not even a breath. And like, see, here's my issue with that. I think if she had been coming from a place of, like, friendship, like, number one, he shouldn't know this. I honestly don't think he should, because he needs to let her go. And she's yes. going to make her own life choices, and he can't keep inserting himself into her life. She's broken up with him. He shouldn't know this. It's none of his business. But I get, like, as a friend, wanting to tell a friend that. But that's not why she tells him. She tells him it's a purely selfish act. She tells him because she doesn't do it even in Debbie's interest to, like, try to save her. She does it, like, as a way to manipulate him into going to this party that neither of them have any business being at.
Yeah, and I also think even if she was doing it for, like, a good reason, doing it at the party is not the way. I mean, what is Debbie going to cancel the party, like, 5 minutes before the indoctrination thing? Like,
most
people are not going to, like, call it, oh, yeah, you're right, I'm going to call this off. Like, most people are a little stubborn, and they will be like, no, I'm going to do this even more, which is kind of what Debbie does.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, but like I said, they really have a zero business being at this party. Like, they are so unprepared for this. They go in there. There is no Hollis or whatever the bouncer's name was. Like, he isn't there. So, like, they have no business being at this. They are so... outnumbered. It's insane. Like, the way that they are it's so stupid. What are you guys doing?
I can't believe that they didn't have, like, some sort of discussed exit strategy for this. Like, everyone turning into werewolves seems like a really high probability of happening.
Right. And it's, like, not a zero probability, so they should have planned for it.
It was just really wild. I do think it was really funny how, like, immediately Debbie clocked Sookie, like, who the fuck is this bitch at my party? And, like, Alcide has to come over and be like, she's with me. And then that's when Debbie just decides, like, okay, well, you're gonna see how serious I am about all of this.
And, like, she's kind of right. Like, he kind of does.
I mean, she's not right to join,
like,
the
that
Nazis,
there is no,
but yeah,
absolutely not. Yeah. But, like, she's right to, like, kind of force him to, like, force him to witness it, because, like, if he's showing up at this, like, place where he has no business being, like, clearly he needs a very strong, like,
I'm kind of wondering even
that,
how,
like,
they
this
got
is
in.
Over.
Like, it seems like the kind of party where there'd be, like, an invitation list.
And they all know Alcide, so they know that he shouldn't be there. Even if they want to let, like, a hot girl in, Asuki is going as, that's fair, but, like, why would they let Alcide in? They know who he is, and they know his past relationship with Debbie, and they know that he is not part of this Nazi pack. So how did he get in?
Yeah, it doesn't really make any sense. But we do learn that Russell is very much involved with the Nazi pack. We knew he, like, knew Cooter and all of that, but we didn't know that he was, like, basically their leader. He, like, gives them all shot glasses of his blood, and brands Debbie, and he says he's been collaborating with the werewolves for a very long time, and I am just really curious how that got all hooked up together.
Yeah, I am too. Like, I don't know if the show is ever going to explain this. I don't remember.
I don't remember either.
And they don't need to. But no. I personally am very curious, like you said, about the origin of this, because we know that, like, Operation Werewolf was definitely a Nazi thing, and, like, you know, they were doing Nazi things, but, like, it also predates that, because Eric knows that it was like, you know, like a runic thing. Mm-hmm. That way predated. So how did they get involved with Nazis? How did they, like, the Nazis come up and they're like, hey, we like the cut of your jib or whatever. how did they get involved with Nazis? How did that come to be? Like, I want a compendium for, like, every show that I watch. I want a compendium.
Yeah. I've been thinking lately about, like, the best medium for different stories. Like, that's just something I've been interested in. And I feel like this, like, Nazi werewolf Russell collaboration would be really nice in, like, a short graphic novel or something like that.
That would be dope.
That would be the method. That would be the medium I would want for that story, with, like, awesome, I love that drawing.
And I think you brought this up before, because, like, we all originally met through a Game of Thrones group, like a podcast group and everything. So obviously, like, we are into that stuff and into, like, House of the Dragon, and House of the Dragon is based off of Fire and Blood, which is not a Game of Thrones book. It is a it's a historical book. It's like a textbook, basically, that takes place in Westeros history, that reads as a dry textbook. It's not like a narrative story. And I think you brought this up. We talked about it earlier.
Yes.
That you would want, like, yeah, like, I think I almost want something like that for, like, everything that I watch, because, like, there's all these details that you don't want necessarily. It doesn't make narrative sense to put it in the story itself.
But, yeah,
like, give me ancillary material. Give me homework. I want to do homework.
Did you read the Locked Tomb series?
I have read Gideon, and I have I've started Harrow. I haven't finished.
Okay. I read both Gideon and Harrow in January, read them both again in February, and just finished Nona last night. And, like, I kind of want that for this, that for that too. Like, I want, like, give me a history book about.
Oh my God, about, you, like, need it for this. That. Because that series throws you in, and it's just like sink or swim, baby.
That's
sink
why
or swim.
I've read,
like,
the first two books twice already. Mm-hmm. But I'm upset. Fully obsessed
I've read.
Now.
I read the first one because I read it years and years ago.
Yeah,
I reread it recently because I was trying to get into Harrow, but, like, I was listening to and it's hard because there's so many, like, names and so much happening that, like, the audiobook was a little bit too hard for me to follow when I was trying to
listen
to it.
I was doing audiobook and physical book at the same time for Nona, and that, like, saved my life.
That is probably what I'm going to have to do.
Yeah.
I do have the physical book of Harrow.
Yeah, I've done that also with, like, the Star Wars High Republic books. I don't know if you're familiar with those. They're, like, 200 years prior to what we really know as Star Wars in, like, the movies and everything. So because of that, it's all characters you've never heard of before. So it was a lot of people to remember. So I was doing both at the same time, and it really helped.
Yeah.
But...
yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
If you ever want to chat about those, I would love that.
Oh, yeah, of course. They're really good. Like, I have had a hard time getting into Harrow, but it's not because there's anything wrong with it. these books are incredible. So I think everybody
they're very complicated, and that is why. Mm-hmm. And actually, Lazzy's reading Nona, and Melissa's read all of them. So like, we're all into it.
Yeah, they're good.
Yes, but yes, please give me a history book of all of my things. Like I have a biography style book on like the Skywalkers from Star Wars. Like I haven't read it, but reads as a history book.
Yeah, I have like 7 different books like that about Buffy.
I love
like encyclopedias, grimoires. I even have a book that's just like stats from like every episode, the, like how many people did she stake, how many like.
Oh yeah, I used to have a book about that for Sex and the City, and it had how many people they all fucked like throughout the show.
Oh my god, that is so funny.
Unsurprisingly, Samantha had the most. But yeah, like I have like Star Trek stuff too, like with like schematics of ships and like space stations. I love that stuff.
It's fun to be a nerd, guys.
It really is. And a nerd would have an exit strategy for this scary party.
I know, like do some fucking homework.
The energy in this room just gets like so terrifying. Like I cannot believe that Saki needs to be told to leave. Like
that is the second that you see like everybody take the shot and start getting all like wily, I am out the door 10 minutes before
that. They were
that.
Rowdy like, as fuck. Yeah.
That was just bad vibes all around.
But she did learn that Cooter is one of the people that took Bill. So there was a point to all of that.
Yeah. And that he's associated with Russell, who, not for nothing, is... shows up to this party like in sunglasses. He's vibing, he's feeling himself. Love that for him. He's got this whole different like persona for his like werewolf Nazi party.
It's really interesting. He just seems like someone that code switches really easily, like depending on who he's around. Like he's just really good.
That's a really good way to put it. Yeah. So this scene where she's running out should have been the cliffhanger.
That would have been a great cliffhanger.
We agree on this. It would have been a good cliffhanger. The cliffhanger we got, however, was just Russell, Lorena, and Bill having a little meal.
That's not a cliffhanger.
It's, it's so funny in an episode like this where there's such a clear cliffhanger, like something that was just like, you know, and True Blood loves to open. Mm-hmm. Yeah, True Blood loves to open and close its episodes like in a really punchy way. Like not even it doesn't even have to be like a strict cliffhanger to do so, but it's always really punchy, almost always. But then you sometimes get an episode like this where there's like such a clear winner that should have been the last scene.
All I feel like this cliffhanger is telling us is that Bill's going along with this. That's it. That we already knew.
Yeah. Yeah. So on that note, are we ready to rank that cliffhanger?
Rank that cliffhanger or not cliffhanger.
Yeah, rank that. Okay. Let's see. So I'm prepared to rank it pretty low.
Yeah, I'm good with that. I feel like I do think that like Bill at Jessica's house is like definitely a little bit higher than this. Because that actually is like we kind of didn't really know what was going to happen after
and I do feel like Bill biting Suki during sex is lower because it's just I don't feel any kind of anything. It's just kind
that
of like
shit was
it's almost
inevitable.
Like it's like a romantic scene.
And then we in that same area we have Bill surrounded by a pack of wolves, which I think is a little bit more cliffhanger-y because like it ends before like the fight. So
yeah.
Do you want to rank this in between Bill surrounded by a pack of wolves and Bill biting Suki during sex?
I'm very comfortable with that placement.
Awesome. So this is the new 25. Pack of wolves is 24 and biting during sex is 26.
Sounds good.
Awesome.
All right. So as far as character intros, we had one, sort of. I don't remember a ton about this show or this season. But I don't remember if Janice has any kind of future here, but she's there and she's cool. We like her.
Yeah, I don't remember if Janice shows up again, but she's actually very similar to her character in the book. She owns a salon. The only difference is Sookie goes to the salon to get a makeover instead of her coming to Elsie's. And Sookie helps her with, like, a client that's stealing her earrings. But yeah, Janice seems like a good big sister.
She really does. All right, so do we want to get into superlatives?
Yes.
All right, so spoiler alert, I agree with both of your choices here for chaotic and horny. So take it away, Elise.
The most chaotic is 100% Jason demanding that Andy make him a police officer. And it's even, like, bonkers. It's even more bonkers because Jason's blackmailing him and saying he'll tell everyone the truth about eggs. And I'm like, Jason, you're going to just admit to murder? Like, you lose in that case.
Like, this is just another... It really doesn't. This is such another case of, like, every time Jason does stupid shit like this, I just am reminded of the Lafayette quote, use a stupid bitch, Jason Stackhouse. Yes. And I literally will say it out loud while I'm watching the show. And that's I did in this case because this is so fucking stupid. Like Jason blackmailing Andy so he can be the worst and dumbest cop ever. Like, I don't need to know the legal blood alcohol limit. I don't need to know, but bro, those are the laws that you are wanting to enforce. You have to fucking know them. Like, we have enough shitty fucking cops in this world that we don't need you out there not even knowing a law. You tackled a guy and thought it was pretty cool, and so, oh my god, just the dumbest bitch.
But what about his paramilitary training?
Take a shot every time he cites his paramilitary training.
We still love you, Jason Stackhouse.
Use just a stupid bitch.
I for most horny, I didn't think that this episode had, like, it wasn't the most horny episode of episodes, especially since Franklin is terrifying now.
Yeah.
But I would say that the winner for me is Eric for Sookie. He's daydreaming. We already, like, kind of went through this, but, like, he's daydreaming when that Estonian hottie is just literally dancing in front of him to the point where she, like, goes away afterwards.
She's, like, rightfully offended.
Yeah.
His mind is elsewhere, and it is in a very weirdly wholesome place. So, yeah, I totally agree. Eric is the most horny for Sookie.
All right. Yeah.
Do we want to talk book spoilers and future TV spoilers?
Yes.
Now is your time to skedaddle, unless you don't care about spoilers, in which case, embrace the chaos.
So in the book, the bar that they go to is not a werebar. It's owned by vampires, and it's actually, like, everyone... I don't remember if this is the official name of it, but everyone calls it Club Dead. So that's, like, the title of the book. So it was, like, me, Leo, pointing at the book book title. The bouncer is a goblin, which Sookie has never met one before, and they are really small but, like, really strong. I'm just glad that they're not bankers, like in another series. And yeah, so there's So that's kind of fun, that it's, like, a bar that is just for, like, soups in general. There's also a scene where, like, Debbie's being super bitchy to Sookie and mentions, like, a birthmark on Alcide's body and, like, to kind of, like, test Sookie on, like, whether they're actually sleeping together. And so Alcide remembers that Sookie can read his mind, so he's like, it's on my right butt cheek, it looks like a rabbit. And so Sookie's like, oh yeah, I love bunnies. And, like, Debbie gets so mad, and it was just really, that was really funny. And I will lastly say that the vibe at the party, I mean, the party is completely different because, like, Debbie is a shapeshifter, not a werewolf in the book, and she's not, I talked a little bit about that last week, and she's also not, like, it is, like, an engagement thing. She's not, like, getting indoctrinated into anything in the book. But, like, the party was playing heavy metal, and then they switched to Good Enough by Sarah McLachlan. And I just, like, am dying laughing at thinking about that song playing at Lupine's.
That is so funny. Imagine, like, mid-transition and Sarah McLachlan comes on.
And they play like Dragula next or something.
A very extreme tonal shift there.
That's great.
All right. Well, any other thoughts?
Oh, I just real quick wanted to mention, because we had kind of touched on it before, about Tommy and Jolie future stuff. Yeah. I do, you had reminded me this recently. Basically, it's pretty obvious that Jolie uses Tommy for dog fighting. And that makes a lot of sense because his go-to animal is a pit bull. We do love pit bulls here. They do have a bad reputation, and that is obviously very much based in how humans have treated them. But yeah, so it's not a good scene over there in that family.
Yeah, I was kind of instantly reminded of it when Tommy took his shirt off when they were going to go, when they went running together. And you see all of those scars all over him. And yeah. It was kind of like, oh my God, I remember that. Yeah, that he was being used for dog fighting, which is just awful. Like, how fucking sick can you be? Like, that's your child. Anyway, great family bonding. I really hope that Sam and Tommy can... but that Sam and Tommy can, like, forge some sort of relationship together. I remember some things. I don't think it goes very well for them since we are in the spoiler section, but it's really sad because I feel like Tommy just never had a chance. He's only like 19.
Yeah, he's really young.
Yeah.
I mean, that's technically still a teenager, I guess.
Yeah. Yep. Well, on that depressing note, I think we did it.
we did it.
Covered the episode. All right. Awesome. Elise, where can the people find you?
The people can find me on Blue Sky, Letterboxd, and Storygraph at Chicken Tendi. That's T-E-N-D-I. You can find my other podcast, Podrates, a Deep Space Nine rewatch podcast, on Blue Sky and Instagram at Podrates, W-R-A-I-T-H-S, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
And you can find me on Instagram, mostly just Instagram, honestly, at Ragey Cakes. You can also find my YA podcast that mostly covers YA, sometimes not YA, when we are podcasting, which we're kind of in a hiatus at the moment. But you can find us on Instagram and all the places at Actia Age. At Actia Age, I think.
That's true.
Let me just, is that right?
I think it is. I'm
suddenly forgetting.
That's all right.
It is, yes, it is at ActH. It's been a while, all right?
You guys have busy lives.
Yeah, we do. But we do have like a backlog of like 60-something episodes. So go take a look if you like YA, fiction, romantasy, all that stuff.
I like that.
All right, so.
I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good term. It's a good portmanteau. All right. So, as always, we want to give a very, very huge thank you to DJ Empirical for our incredible theme. You can find the podcast on Instagram and Blue Sky at Fangbangers Pod, and email us your chaotic, horny thoughts on True Blood, please, to fangbangerspod@gmail.com. I'm Tasia, and my blood type is Killing Brother Cousins.
And I'm Elise, and my blood type is cheese and rice.
Cheese and rice. Bye.
Bye.